Greg, come in here.
What is it?
Well, I'm announcing my annual list of the top 10 numbers between 1 and 10.
This is something you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, starting this year. Are you ready?
I guess so.
At number 10, 2.
Huh, 2 had a bad year?
Yeah, Back to the Future 2 takes place in 2015, when there are flying cars and hoverboards and no lawyers, and none of that stuff even happened. Bad 2.
Okay, keep going.
Number 9, 9. Seriously, 9, you have to try harder if you want to get out of 9th place. Otherwise, you're just this weird Beatles song. Number 8, 6. Half a dozen? Half a dozen what? There wasn't even half a dozen of anything this year. Number 7, 4. And that's a gift. Fantastic Four was one of the worst movies of the year. Number 6, 7. 7 is the new 2. I could really see 7 taking off and maybe getting to number 4 next year.
This is getting really hard to follow.
Number 5, 10. See, unfortunately, 10 is on the way down, not on the way up. Remember how people used to say, she's a 10, but now it's 13 at least, and Spinal Tap speakers go up to 11. If I were 10, I'd hire a publicist. Number 4 is 5. 5 is trending. I like what I saw 5 doing this year. Halo 5, Scandal Season 5, Homeland Season 5.
In a weaker field, 5 could have been 1.
Exactly. Now, number 3 is 8. 8 is timeless. You could put it on its side and it's infinity. Number 2 is 1. I think everybody agrees that number 1 needs to be taken down a peg. And number 1 on my annual list of the top 10 numbers between 1 and 10...
Virtual drum roll...
3.
And that's because...
It was the only number left. Today on the Nose, year-end lists, candidate quirks, and new trends and forms of address. And now he challenged Marco Rubio to a water-drinking contest and had an accident. Colin McEnroe.
You know, I underestimated him. I thought I could just keep up with him the way he drinks water, but it turns out you need to train. You need to get yourself ready for this. So, first of all, welcome to The Nose, our weekly conversation about culture, broadly interpreted, that word, culture. Joining us now is Rand Richards Cooper, a writer, critic, gourmand, etc. Also with us from the Mark Twain House is Jacques Lamar, also a playwright. And then from the world of letters, it is Rebecca Castellani. From the world of letters and Scotland, Rebecca Castellani. And speaking of the world of letters, we're going to start out. I'll tell you our secondary and tertiary topics. I hope we can get to all of them today. But a little bit later in the show, we are going to be talking about the proliferation of year-end lists, including, of course, lists of the top 10 numbers between 1 and 10. But most of them are, you know, best movies, best this, best that. I happen to enjoy this season. It's my favorite time of the year. I love end-of-the-year lists, but not everybody does. This year, even the Obamas put out their best of lists. I think that's a first for a presidential couple. I could be wrong. Anyway, do we find them assaulting or do we actually enjoy having them around? We'll also talk very specifically about one kind of year-end list. And then towards the end, we're going to talk about, first of all, Marco Rubio's water drinking and also this kind of footage dump of Ted Cruz trying to record campaign moments with his family and sort of just the general awkwardness of Ted Cruz and about whether or not quirky candidates are endearing or they just freak us out, and if so, what's the difference? So all of that is yet to come, but we're going to start out in the world of letters with a couple of things that have happened this week. Actually, it was sort of last Wednesday. The New York Times announced or at least used a new honorific or form of address, MX period, mix, in a story that quoted Senya Hardwick, a bookshop employee who didn't want to be assigned a gender by the newspaper. This is an increasing problem. The Washington Post has been experimenting with they as a singular pronoun, so it would be Senya Hardwick talked about the things that they would put on their top 10 list, but that would be only Senya Hardwick who would be doing that. Very complicated, very hard. So we've got a lot of other things in the world of sort of grammar and usage that we'll try to get through as fast as we can. It's really complicated. It's really hard. And so, Rand Cooper, I'll start with you. Do you regard this as an intriguing challenge to try to tackle all this new stuff, or would we be better off just not messing around with the language so much?
Well, of course, the reality of the new is inescapable, and language must eventually find useful ways to accommodate it. So one of the things I'm going to express some particular skepticism about they and about mix, but let's just deal with principles and temperaments first. one thing that's always interesting to me about new words and what's allowed in is and changes in language generally, they sort of reveal people's political, for want of a better word, temperaments vis-a-vis change. And that's got nothing to do with what your politics are. I mean, I have just standard liberal left of center opinions about things, but I tend to view a lot of these changes with like instinctive skepticism. Sort of the inner conservative comes out. And that's something that, you know, I'm aware has to be kept at bay. Now, with they, it just seems to me a wildly unfortunate choice of an alternate pronoun, because it's so frankly confusing, is for the reason you just said.
Yeah, it's very hard to get through. I think we did talk about this one time before. On the other hand, Rebecca, as Rand says, the language is changing. Something has to be done. There are people – well, I guess it's not axiomatic that just because there are people who want the language to do something that it has to do that, but it usually does.
I think that keeping a record of our language, no matter how seemingly inane, I think, you know, adding words like fleek and yes with three A's to the dictionary is, you know, on the surface, rather crazy. But keeping a record of history through language has been something we've been doing since the dawn of language and something I believe we should continue doing.
Well, how about this form of address thing? I mean, one argument you could make is just get rid of forms of address,
well,
right?
Well, that's my next point there, because I still get so bent out of shape when I have to fill out a form and I have to just differentiate between Miss, Ms., and Mrs., and men get Mr. So why is my marital status necessary when men get one term? And now we have all these other terms. Why do we even need it anymore? You are who you are. People know you. Usually you can kind of tell by a name. And why does it matter?
Because the New York Times on Second Reference always refers to Meatloaf as Mr. Loaf. So they feel the need to do that. And so Jacques, but I
did they really call him Mr. Loaf?
They call him Mr. Loaf. Stevie Wonder's Mr. Wonder. I mean, you know.
Unnecessary.
So, Mr. Loaf.
M. Loaf.
If he's MX, then he's Mixed Loaf.
He could be Mixed Loaf. Yeah, which sounds delicious, actually. Mixed Loaf sounds really good. So, Jacques, I think I can guess why Rand is going to have a very specific question about MX period pronounced mix. Because, like, it sort of sounds wrong somehow, right?
I was actually first time coming across Mix, I was handed a business card from a transgender individual, and I noticed that the prefix was Mix, or not prefix, what's the honorific, mm-hmm. was Mix, and so I know that this person identifies as transgender. So I didn't ask how it was pronounced. I ended up going on the interwebs to find out. I mean, I know this person well enough that I would just refer to them by their first name anyway.
But you might say, in the words of the song, have you met Mix Jones?
Me and Mix Jones.
Yeah, mixes. Yeah.
So, it's interesting because I have a transgender friend on Facebook who was very upset about how they're a playwright and how they were being addressed by a critic. In the review, because they wanted to be referred to as they instead of she.
You did it really well just then. You did it seemingly effortlessly.
Well, you know, the thing is, I have a lot of transgender friends, and I've fallen into potholes. And I think I think there is a certain amount of wanting to own the gender that you identify with, and that gender is fluid. And that there is, you know, there are places between Mr. and Ms. or Mr. and Miss or Mrs. So I think that there's a certain kind of, creating your own identity that's happening with these words. And there's a kind of a political, socio-political component to saying that we want to be addressed differently. And now when I see a form, I was at the doctor's office. And there was a choice of to check off male or female. I felt bad for my friends who are, you know, believe that they are, somewhere in between.
Mix, though, sounds like a collie mix or something like that. I don't know if I would pick that
Well,
one.
First of all, there's the wasn't it the MX missiles, back? So there's an awkward military reference. But I would just shear off the principles that Jacques just eloquently articulated from this particular solution, which is they is A, it's confusing. B, there's like this weird, almost demonic You know, Beelzebub-like, like in the Shining, you know, the Exorcist.
We Are Legion.
We Are Legion. So there's this We Are Legion a part of it.
I don't know how many people are going
to
make that.
Well, it also corresponds to, to a sort of standard grammatical error when a plural pronoun is used in places when singular should be. They're just. I'm not objecting at all to the principle that Jacques articulated. I think this particular solution
is a different word.
Is multiply awkward.
And there are there should be a different word, new word created.
Right. Well, there are a whole bunch of them floating around too, right? There's Z's.
The other thing that I will say is people vote. A culture votes with its feet, or in this case, with its mouth. Over time.
Or mouse.
And with a culture votes with their – no, okay, forget it. And over time, these decisions are made in a sort of de facto way. What's interesting about the role of the New York Times or of dictionaries, this is a sort of interesting parallel to the role that the Supreme Court plays vis-a-vis evolving social mores. Should a dictionary or a newspaper sort of be on the forefront of this, making decisions that reflect what it believes is coming next, or should it sort of play a catch-up role and validate this once it's sort of already been accomplished culturally? By the way, I don't have an answer to that, but I think it sets up the problem.
So what do you think the Times should have done then in the instance of this particular person, that they just drop the honorific altogether, which is what most newspapers would
Wouldn't
do?
Wouldn't you use the one that they want to go by, though? Isn't that kind of the back?
Well, that's not how newspapers – I mean, newspaper-style books are inherently Procrustean, right? I mean, they sort of make things sort of fit. And the goal of the newspaper-style book is to have everybody at the newspaper do the same thing as opposed to doing what the person you're talking to wants you to do. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's great, but that's what they exist for. So my guess is that they're going to be a little bit more prescriptive and a little less descriptive. Dictionaries, which we'll talk about – and if we have a couple of seconds here where I'm under a different kind of clock today would be a little bit different. Well, actually, let's do the dictionary thing right away. So, Rebecca, you kind of alluded to this, that we also saw an article about the fact that dictionaries, particularly online dictionaries, but all kinds of dictionaries, are much more open to very quickly adopting things like Fleek and Yaz with three A's and WTF and NSFW and Bay and Bezzy and YOLO and Wah and Fur Baby and MK. All these things are getting into various online dictionaries instead of waiting to see whether or not they prove themselves. Now you're back to Rand's question. What should dictionaries do? Should dictionaries try to create order or just reflect chaos?
I don't know. I go back and forth on this because there is that conservative in me that wants to keep the dictionaries pure with real words that aren't abbreviations or amalgamations of several words or particularly trendy. However, as I said before, I do think that keeping a record of language, even if it's just to remind us how silly we've become, is a worthwhile endeavor and something that we should continue to do, if not maybe restrict them to the online dictionaries and not taint the poor OED with Queen and Yas and all these other crazy words that we've invented in the last year.
Although, Jacques, one thing I want a dictionary to do, I want to be able to look up a word I don't know. And a lot of these words that come flying at me, I'd like to look them up somewhere.
What happened to Urban Dictionary?
Because I love Urban Dictionary. But the thing is, Urban Dictionary is crowdsourced.
Right.
And so it's not authoritative
in
any way.
Maybe it's time for an official Oxford English Urban
Dictionary. Well, I think that's sort of where they're headed with the online thing. I've seen YOLO and I didn't know what it meant until we started this conversation, that this was going to be a subject. And I was like, oh, I can finally find out what YOLO means. Now I've already forgotten what it means.
You only live once.
You only live once. That's right. And so I was happy that there was a resource there that was trustworthy and not misleading when it came to it. I don't see a problem with
it. I do think that etymologically it's interesting to figure out where these words have came from.
Yeah.
Although, Rand, this will probably be the last comment before we go to break here, but dictionaries have two functions. One of them is the one we're talking about. You see something, you don't know it, you look it up. And maybe it says something like non-standard or who knows whether this is going to make it into the canon or something next to it, but at least you can find it. But the other way that my parents used to use it, and sometimes we do use it in journalism, which is to figure out whether a word is a real word or not. So the dictionary is the thing you pull off the shelf to adjudicate something, like what's the status of the language right now vis-a-vis this word. And on that score, opening up the floodgates to pretty much everybody starts to water down its significance that way.
Well, it's interesting, and I guess this just restates the problem, but there's an inherent tension with the dictionary between its gatekeeping function and its sort of descriptive historian function. So you can sort of stress which side is most important to you? I think we live in an age, certainly here, in a cultural moment that would stress the sort of keeping up with what's happening in the culture function of a dictionary, and that's a great function of a dictionary. But I don't think that any of us would want to. Well, I don't know about any of us, but probably not a lot of us would want to completely eradicate and obliterate the sort of authority function that a dictionary has. And I think the key to that probably has to do with a little bit of persistence over time. As I said, you know, a word, if it makes it, you know, it makes it for at least a while, and it becomes a more powerful meme, lexical meme, that gets into people's minds. And that there's a certain critical threshold above which, like, everyone agrees, oh, baby, that word is in.
But still, you want to be able to look up Bezzy, otherwise you'll have FOMO. Anyway, we have to go. We have to take a quick break.
Yeah,
we'll be back.
Queen.
Yes.
Hickey, hockey, holy, bagel, bugle, bowling, macadamia, vestibule.
So this is the time of year where people start putting out their best of list, best of everything. Even the Obamas, both President and Mrs. Obama, did best of lists. I would argue that they're maybe one of the first couples, maybe the first couple, who have a broad enough sampling of culture to be able to do this. Although obviously Bill Clinton was pretty voracious in lots of ways too. So anyway, Michelle Obama reveals that she loves Uptown Funk by Bruno Mars. That's her song of the year. Her husband says it's Kendrick Lamar's How Much a Dollar Cost. The president, his favorite book, his book of the year is Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff. I saw a tweet from Lauren Groff saying, that's it, I retire. The first lady's, the top of her book list is Light of the World, Elizabeth Alexander's amazing memoir about the death of her husband. The best of a TV show for Barack Obama is The Nick. For Michelle, it's Blackish. So even they do it. And so the first question is, I mean, there's going to be a deluge over the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks of best of lists and people debating best ofs and stuff like that. And so the first question is, do we enjoy that or do we feel assaulted? Are there too many best of lists and is there kind of a feeling like you're running around trying to catch up with other people's best ofs? So, Rebecca, where are you on that?
I love it. Yeah. I find that it's a way for me to catch up on stuff that I didn't know existed. I just was reading best 10 TV shows from the year and there was a Stars drama and I don't really ever watch anything on Stars and it was called Flesh and Bone and it's about ballerinas and it was wonderful and I would never have known about this had that list not come up. So I think it is kind of a catch-all for things you may have missed in the year. I do think it's done to excess when you're seeing, you know, the best in Taylor Swift squad for 2015 drives me a little nuts. But when it comes to music and TV, I don't mind it.
Actually, Jacques contributed to that list, I think, the best in Taylor Swift. How do you feel about that?
You know, on Taylor Swift squad or just
the
top 10 list?
The top 10 list, best of list, all that kind of stuff.
You know, I'm always, always drawn to them. Mm-hmm. I'm always drawn to them, and I'm almost always infuriated as a result of them. Like, I just got the Rolling Stone with their best of, and it's, you know, as per usual, half the list are, you know, white men in their 60s who they, you know, no matter
and
what
they're not even musicians. They're just white men in their 60s.
Well, no, but I mean, it's like, you know, it's like Don Henley's album and all these things, you know, like it seems like they still can't look at sort of these young, vital artists. It's like last year they named U2's album the best album of the year. And it's like, exactly. And it's like, really? Really? And so, and oftentimes I would run out and, you know, get or download whatever they considered the best album of the year. And 1 year it was
Frank Ocean.
Frank Ocean's.
Great album. Yeah.
Which is a
good
album.
Great album.
Yeah, but I like listened to it once and so.
Oh, why see the world when you've got the beach? Come on now.
And so, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad album, but, you know, I've stopped using it as a means of making cultural decisions for me. I just still navigate by my own bad taste.
I do love the idea that President Obama is listening to that Kendrick Lamar.
Me too.
CD. That makes me
and
happy.
Uptown Delightful. Funk is a jam.
Yeah.
I'm Team FLOTUS on this one.
So I'm with you on that too. So, Randa, what about this? Do they play a useful function or are they just kind of intellectual flotsam at this point?
No. It's actually, I suppose, somewhat confessionally, I'll say I approach the end of the year and its lists with dread and indeed anxiety. And
because you're afraid you won't be on them?
No. No, okay. Good God, not that. And I don't mind fishing or poaching from other people's interesting lists. That's not the problem. But the prospect of making such a list, it reminds me, like almost nothing else does, of this cultural predicament that we're in. Or maybe you guys aren't. You're confident making lists. But there's almost nothing that I feel sufficiently comprehensively knowledgeable about, even to begin to make a list. And it makes me recall what I now think of as like a prelapsarian experience of childhood, which is having been a sports geek at age, say, 12, and I knew everything about, say, the National Football League. And I would have been able to talk vehemently and passionately for hours about just about every player in the league. Nowadays, I feel like I'm running around trying to get a few crumbs of this or that slice of the cultural pie. And it's sad but true that there's no part of that cultural pie, you know, that I've eaten enough of to be able to sit. Like, probably the only list I could make with any authority is restaurants in Central Connecticut. Yeah, you know, there, boy, I feel,
I would read that list.
I feel pretty secure. But otherwise, it's like, yeah, okay, I read this novel I like, but oh, how about those other 98 novels that I didn't read? Or, and then, you know, TV, yeah, I have like these four shows I watch, but I mean, there's like so many amazing shows that I don't even know the names of. So that's why I feel honestly palpable anxiety tinged slightly with cultural despair.
But that's a good argument for like Rand Cooper's top favorite 10 things of 2015, and then they could be anything. And I see more and more lists like that too that don't stick to a discipline or a category. They just sort of move around a lot. And so Slate had one this week that wasn't rooted in any particular character, any category. I just gave it away. It's sort of best character of the year, but it says the bulldozer charisma of Empire's Cookie, the perfect narrative use of sadness in Inside Out, the sneaky comic timing of LeBron James and Trainwreck, tenacious clever Pip and Jonathan Franzen's purity, Jessica Jones's nightmare-inducing Kilgrave. Those are some of their favorite characters, and then some of their critics chimed in with racist Atticus Finch and Ghost at a Watchman, Titus Andromedon, whom we've just been rhapsodizing about off the air, and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Robert Durst, who's an actual real-life human being, in The Jinx, Larry David playing Bernie Sanders. I mean, I like that idea because it's not stuck in a category. It's like all kinds of things.
Well, so then I would start with Pope Francis.
Pope Francis is your favorite character of the year?
Since I'm not trying to be responsible to any category.
Yeah, I like it. I like
I would go with deviled eggs.
Yeah, see?
Because
see?
They're making a very interesting culinary comeback.
This is a great list already. Pope Francis and deviled eggs, although he might be a little uncertain about his proximity to deviled eggs.
Third, but I would go with Dirk Nowitzki.
There's always going to be a big German somewhere on Rand's list. See, that's a good list.
And so on.
Yeah, and so on.
Yeah.
So did you have a favorite character of the year? Who would you pick?
Oh, I'm really back and forth between my deep love of Titus Andromedon and the Pinot Noir ode. And I tell you what, I was blown away by The Jinx and Robert Durst and that figure. And Kate McKinnon's impression of Robert Durst also deserves to be on that list.
Yeah, sort of almost anything that McKinnon's Hillary Clinton.
Her Hillary
also
is perfect.
And almost anything that Kate McKinnon does.
Yeah, let's just call it Kate McKinnon and be done with it.
One of my favorite things of the year was Robert Durst guilt burping. You know how he was doing that? He was kind of burping guiltily when he realized that he'd sort of been caught.
There was really something mesmerizing, particularly mesmerizing about Durst, don't you think?
His black eyes just haunt my dreams to this day.
I mean, you can cite all of these individual things. And was it Laura Miller who wrote that in that list that you passed along?
I think it might be, yeah. And
so there are all these the fact that he had a flesh-toned latex mask with him. So you can cite all when he was apprehended. You can cite all these individual things. But there's some way in which he speaks to something larger culturally that's really interesting and scary.
Jacques, what's on your highly eclectic list? Give us one or two things. Things from 2015. If you need time to think, I'll tell you while you're thinking. Go ahead.
I already admitted to you guys communally via email that I became obsessed with the Carly Rae Jepsen song, I Really, 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 Really Like You. Mm-hmm. It was my ringtone. Everyone in the office hated me for it. The video is the cutest thing in the world, and I was so surprised it wasn't, you know, the song of the summer. Darn you, Uptown Funk, but I also love that song. And David Crabb. I don't know if you know. He's a mouth Grand Slam winner, and he's got a memoir called Bad Kid about his time growing up in Texas as a gay goth, and it's funny and heartbreaking. And he's like my little personal hero now.
All right, the only one that I had to contribute looking at Slate's list. Nothing mesmerized me as much this year, on the screen anyway, as Jason Segel as David Foster Wallace in the end of the tour. What a character. I mean, David Foster Wallace himself is an amazing character. And then what Jason Segel did with this, I really felt like I was not watching acting, which is kind of that rare feeling. So when I start my top 10 list or my best of the year or whatever, Pope Francis would be hard to keep off my list. He's been really good this year, huh? All right. So we're going to take a little break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about candidate quirks. There's been some interesting things going on with Ted Cruz in the last 24 hours. Very interesting things. And then Marco Rubio and his peculiar affection for water. I mean, we all like water, but this is getting a little extreme.
I'm making a list. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Cross a few off, then I'll start again.
Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe and me, Kyone Wolf, with help from Betsy Kaplan, who could water drink Marco Rubio under the table. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Sarah Flaherty and Amanda Gallagher appear on our Best Interns of 2015 list. The part of Bill Curry was played by Uncle Sam the Eagle. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Here and Now staff yelling, "You get to be the monkey in the house," visit our website, WNPR.org/Colin. On Monday's show, we consider the return of Serial, and Justice Scalia kicks a racial tripwire. And now, back to the nose.
All right, so we are back. I hope we have time to explain You Get to Be the Monkey in the House, which I think would be the title of this nose episode. But with us, Rand Richard Cooper, Jacques Lamar, and Rebecca Castellani, we're talking about candidate quirks right now. And this ranges from Marco Rubio's formerly noted love of water. And by the way, that is true, what you just said. I mean, actually, I mentioned this in Betsy Kaplan's presence, and Betsy Kaplan, one of our producers, she's not one to brag, but she said, "I could take him. She could drink more water than Marco Rubio." I mean, I've seen her do it. So anyway, there's this whole thing, and we'll explain a little bit more about that in just a second, ranging from the peculiarities of Ted Cruz. He's trying harder to be kind of a regular person. This has not always gone well. There's this huge video dump of 15 to 16 hours of video, the raw video that was shot for future campaign commercials, which unfortunately various members of the press found and started screening and started kind of seeing certain levels of awkwardness that seemed to persist in his own life. And then there's – I don't know if it's fair. There's the much-discussed Donald Trump's encounter with the Eagle, where the Eagle kind of gets mad at him at a certain point. I don't know. I think I would react to an angry Eagle pretty much the same way. Maybe that's not a quirk. But one thing that we know is that when candidates are quirky, when they do something odd, we can have two possible reactions to it. You know, that's kind of endearing. That's kind of nice. He's showing – he or she is showing his or her human side. They're showing their human side. Or we can go, "That's really weird." And a lot of times it's the thing that people take for granted about themselves. LBJ thought it was okay to pick up a dog by its ears. The rest of the country did not. You know, there are things like that where it just seems as though there's something very, very strange about this person. I can come up with other examples. And so, yes, indeed, Marco Rubio does drink a lot of water. He's kind of famous for it. He became famous 5 years was more recently than that, after a speech by President Obama, a State of the Union speech. Rubio was chosen to give the Republican response, and he couldn't get through it without drinking out of this water bottle. But apparently it's something he does all the time. Well, actually, let's listen to Donald Trump, because you know if Donald Trump says it's probably true. So here's Donald Trump explaining it.
Marco Rubio, who has the worst voting record in the United States Senate, and a young guy, although he sweats more than any young person I've ever seen in my life. I've never seen a person sweat. I've never seen a guy down water like he downs water. I've never seen – they bring it in buckets for this guy.
That's Jeb Bush and John Kasich laughing in the background. No, not really. No. And Ted Cruz is kind of on this, like,
that was, you know, a little Trumpian of you, right?
Yeah. Ted Cruz, who's kind of, you know, trying to get people to like him. He's famously unlikable. The New York Times had this description of him kind of working a crowd. He goes up to a little boy. He says he squatted. He squinted. He had heard something about a toy collection. And so about 3 feet above the floor of an American Legion Hall, the senator began his questioning. "You have lots of toys?" he asked 3-year-old Isaac Jocelyn. "Nothing." "What's your favorite toy?" More silence. "Do you have a dinosaur? Do you have a fire truck? Do you have a toy monkey?" Isaac stared blankly. "A toy monkey," Mr. Cruz shouted, revving for a punchline no one understood. "You know what that means? You get to be the monkey in the house." So these are candidates trying to be regular people, and they often are not. So, I mean, I don't know. How do we feel about things like that? Does it undercut? Well, actually, and Rebecca, I know you've been studying some of the Ted Cruz commercial tapes. As a young person, do these people now strike you as more Martian-like than before?
Ted Cruz, yes. Marco Rubio, strangely, no. Mm-hmm. The water thing with him somehow endeared me to him more. I think that I found it rather humanizing, if not an outright endearing. And I think that, you know, in this election in particular, any eccentricity counts when you're trying to trump Trump. Ted Cruz's video was one of the most bizarre things I have ever seen. It was just these bizarre staged false conversations where he's getting his niece and nephew to read lines and his poor mother. And it was just bizarre. And I don't know. I then went on a rampage of reading all this stuff about Ted Cruz and some of the things he said. I mean, he's been the first candidate to openly say, "You wouldn't want to have a drink with me in a bar. I'm pretty boring." He is very clearly.
But then he said, "But I would drive you home."
But he'd drive you home.
Yeah, he said, "I'll drive you home and you'll get home safe."
Yeah, he uses, you know, things like Jiminy Cricket, and it just seems very rehearsed and disingenuous to me. And awkward. He's just awkward.
There was Frank Bruni a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times wrote a column. Now, obviously, the New York Times has its politics and Cruz is not going to fare very well. But the piece very convincingly set out to show that basically anyone who has ever known Cruz really, really dislikes him. And people who have worked with him, people he's worked for, people who have worked for him, he has not only inspired no loyalty anywhere, but he's inspired a great deal of loathing. And there were just prime quotations from one of his college roommates at Princeton who said, "I would rather open a phone book at random and pick the next president of the United States than have Ted be president." Another one said, why does everyone take such an instant dislike to Ted Cruz? It saves time. and so to humanize the tapes that you were watching, Rebecca, I think are devastating because the attempt to humanize him
absolutely
even with his own family shows him to be woodenly unemotional. And there are these devastating scenes where he's sitting with his own little daughters on the bed,
silent.
And they're rehearsing, and he's waiting for the next prompt. It's between takes. And he's waiting for the next prompt, and he just sits there silently and woodenly with his two little girls, unable or unwilling, it seems, to engage in any kind of fatherly bantering byplay with
them. It was like a family of robots trying to mimic human behavior as they'd read about it. I mean, it was just awful.
And so, Jacques, to that point, I mean, this is one of the questions we always have about these people. Are they real people? Are they pod people? Are they robots? My favorite example of this, I can't remember what year it was, and there were lots of other reasons not to vote for Steve Forbes, whatever year that was. But there was a description. I think Michael
thought about him in forever.
Yeah, Michael Lewis. I think it was Michael.
Thanks for that.
Yeah, I think Michael Lewis. Somebody, some writer like that, was on the campaign trail and was with Steve Forbes in New Hampshire, where he was going at some Lions Club buffet or something, and he was going through the buffet line, and he was watching very carefully what the people ahead of him did, so that he would know how to be in this buffet line, how he would know like how much to get and what things to put on his plate, because it was just clear that Steve Forbes, who probably did have a pretty cosseted and cocooned life, just had never done this before, so he didn't want to do anything terribly wrong or out of kilter, so he was studying very carefully the behavior of other people. That's disconcerting if they don't live that much in this world.
But you know, I have to say I have a different reaction to the Ted Cruz video. I mean, I found it amusing as a candidate, you know, that I would not vote for, being embarrassed. But at the same time, you are very, you know, this is an awkward situation for their family. You know, it's not like the kids are groomed to be political beasts. It's not like his mother was groomed to be a political beast. It's not like they were wanting to be TV stars. And they are clearly being coached into creating the type of ads that we have seen for years.
Yeah.
Of me with my beautiful children in our very Christian home, and mom loves me and all this stuff. And so I think that there are probably videos of, you know, that are in cutting room floors of candidates we like a lot better that wouldn't seem entirely different.
You know, draw a line and keep your family on the other side of it. Obama has. How much have you ever seen about his daughters? And I don't think that he ever used his family for campaign material.
Michelle possibly, but not the daughters.
Yeah. And one of the raps against Cruz that's reiterated by everyone who's ever known him is that his ambition, to use a word that is only ever used in connection with ambition, is so overweening that nothing will get in its way. And so I lump this into that kind of
thing. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think, you know, if he's trying to paint himself as sort of an anti-Trump, you know, a sweet little family homage,
right,
is a direction to go in.
But yes. You know, but Rebecca, about Marco and the water, I think it's interesting because water humanizes him in an interesting way.
He's definitely a carbon-based life form, right?
Yeah.
He's
like that. We know that. I mean,
he's
just
not a robot.
And also his obvious need for it. There are moments when he has interrupted major speeches. What was the one?
It was like a response to the State of the Union.
And he suddenly lunges off camera and gets this bottle. So there's the suggestion both of basic fit the body and its needs, but also something a little bit more like he needs his water bottle.
No, that's
right.
What endeared me to him was not his need for water, which is a human need we all experience, but
like
the nervousness. It was a nervous
tick. It's a Linus-like blanket.
Yeah,
right.
It was, you know, like biting your fingernails or something. I totally related to it. I can understand it.
It's also very 2015. There's climate change. We're having droughts.
Yeah.
People who want water. It's also very Mad Max Fury Road, you know.
It's invoked.
Yeah, it's very invoked.
I have to say, I was not aware of the water issue. And that, I think, it was the first Republican debate. And when they were introducing him, and he pulls out a water bottle, and he's like, I knew about the drought, so I brought my own water. And I thought, what a terrible joke.
Right.
And I didn't realize it was attached to this history of moistness.
It's a big meme. All right. We've only got about 3 or 4 minutes left. We have to go through our endorsements maybe a little bit more swiftly than usual. So, Rand, you go first.
The year is drawing to a close, 2015. It is the 20th anniversary of the mainstay Hartford institution of Black Eyed Sally's. James Verano opened it in 1995 after taking a trip down to Memphis and New Orleans, and it has served as a high-functioning, delicious, and important place for Hartford for 20 years. So if it somehow has slipped off your radar, get it back on and go to Black Eyed Sally's. There's live music 6 nights a week.
Yeah.
We went in on a Tuesday night. There was a 16-piece brass band, jazz band there. It was awesome.
All right. Jacques, what have you got for us?
I am in the midst of reading a book that actually isn't out until next week, but I really, really enjoyed it as a theater person and as a James Bond fan. It's called License to Quill, and it's by Jacopo Della Quercia. And it's a lot of fun about the gunpowder plot. It involves Guy Fawkes. It's really, really interesting. And I just want to put in a plug that Colin is going to be interviewing Daniel Dennett, the cognitive scientist and philosopher, next Tuesday at the Mark Twain House.
I'm so not ready for that. All right.
That's scary, actually.
Yeah, that is. I feel actually very underpowered there. All right, Rebecca, what have you got for us?
Yeah, 2 quick ones. It's Christmas in Collinsville this weekend. There's a lot of really fun family activities. Tonight they've got horse-drawn carriage rides, tree lighting, a champagne walk from 6 to 9, and the front woman of the Ronettes, Ronnie Spector, will be playing at Bridge Street Live. She goes on at 8. It's going to be real cool. You can get tickets at the door or online, and if you're looking for more information on that event, and I know there's some activities on Saturday too, go to visitcollinsville.com.
Collinsville, the Montmartre of Central Connecticut.
The Montmartre. And I one other real quick one. My really good friend Christine Pettit has got a great project that's coming up for 2016 called Transformations. It's focusing on women's stories after an event of trauma and the way they can remain positive after overcoming adversity. She's kind of really shifting the narrative here. If you know someone who you believe would be suitable for this project, do give Christine an email. She's at christine@pettitpicks.com.
All right. So from our little sort of community bulletin board, our beloved Nose friend, Carolyn Payne, her Connecticut dance, Nutcracker Sweet and Spicy, is at the Aetna Theater, the Wadsworth Athenaeum. I can endorse this because I've seen it in years past. It's really fun. It is not your mother or your father's Nutcracker. And it's tonight at 8 p.m., tomorrow at 8 p.m., and a Sunday at 2 p.m. I mean, really go see it and have fun. And there's, I think, there are Nora cupcake events associated with it. And I don't know what else. There's a red carpet opening night party at Vito's tonight. Anyway, see if you can get behind that. And then here's my other endorsement is a lot of people will go into New York, particularly if they're putting together their top 10 list of the best theater of the year, trying to catch up on plays. Go downtown. I mean, you can see great plays on Broadway, obviously. You pay a lot more money. Downtown, there's just this incredible web of wonderful little theaters where you don't pay as much, whether it's the Vineyard or Barrow Street or the Atlantic, which I think is about to do These Paper Bullets, which is a great show. Anyway, find out about the downtown theaters. I just saw The Flick, which is by Annie Baker. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 2014. It's an amazing play. It is, however, more than 3 hours long. It is, however, frequently very slow. But it's a play that changed me more than any play that I saw this year. It's just an amazing show. And, you know, it's like the ticket is much cheaper than what you're going to pay to see something on Broadway. And you can't get tickets to Hamilton anyway. All right. Nice people are coming here now to tell you why you should support a show like the one you just heard. I hope you will answer the bell.
I already said that one. Avon, Farmington.
All right, number one in the top 10 list of worst public radio pledge drive gifts is a gift certificate to any Boston area Chipotle, valid today only.
I'm Mike Palmer, asking you to support the programming. I promise we have no Chipotle gift cards available. You can support Colin McEnroe and all the programming here at WNPR by giving us a call. 1-800-584-2788 is the number. You can also go online to WNPR.org. Make your contribution there. Lee, we have just under $700 in so far for Colin this hour. That's fantastic, but we need to build on that. We have to keep the momentum going that we've started today. I will be honest, this drive started off slowly, and it did start to pick up over time. But starting yesterday and then through this morning, we have started to see a groundswell of support from our listeners, and that is fantastic because it means that our goal is now within sight. We have done this before. Our listeners have responded before to help us meet goals like this. We know that we can do it again, but only with your help. We need you to join those listeners who have stepped forward in the days and weeks previous to support WNPR and make your contribution as well. Join people like Catherine from South Windsor or Bruce from Shelton, an anonymous donor from Glastonbury who said they love the Colin McEnroe show, anonymous donors from Vernon and West Hartford, as well as, donors from Preston, Bristol, Shelton, and Karen from Southbury. They have all made their pledges this hour. We want you to step forward and join them. Become some of the listeners that make that commitment to become a supporter of the programming here. You can join them, 1-800-584-2788, or go online, WNPR.org.
And there's no better show to support than the Colin McEnroe show because this is something unique. It's very much ours. Colin is such a unique voice on the Connecticut landscape. I mean, he can effortlessly move between fine culture and pop culture. He has great curiosity for art, for music, for politics. I mean, you get everything on this show, and you never know exactly what you're going to find. And, Mike, I know the nose is my favorite. I mean, just looking at what's happening on the news and getting their take on it, and today's show was another great one. Support what he does here. This is our last opportunity this week to support Colin McEnroe's show and your last day, of course, to support this end-of-year campaign. It's so important that you join us right now. And remember, $6 a month, we'll send you that brand-new WNPR Hartford Prince retro calendar. Beautiful item, homemade, designed by artists right here in Hartford. And we'd love to send it to you with our thanks. 1-800-584-2788.
1-800-584-2788 is the number. You can support online at WNPR.org. Help keep this last day strong. We know we can reach this goal, but only with your help. Support the kind of radio where in 1 week you can hear a show about Dante and reading Inferno with prison inmates, and then an entire hour devoted to Mad Magazine all in the same week. Only Colin McEnroe can bring that to you. Only he could bring you a show like this. It's so important that you join those who have supported and support it now. 1-800-584-2788.